If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hello and welcome to the Vector Movement Podcast. I'm your host, Bernadette. We all heard it. Sit up straight, stop slouching, fix your posture, and your back pain will go away. But what if that's not actually true? Despite being told for years that posture is the root cause of back pain, the research and the results tell a different story. Today, I'm joined by Adam Meekins, a physiotherapist and strength and conditioning coach who's built a global reputation for challenging outdated rehab advice and helping people return to movement with confidence. So in this conversation, we unpack the myth of perfect posture, why so many physios still focus on fixing alignment, and what actually helps people with back pain. Whether you're a beginner, a gym goer, or someone who's been in pain for years. If you've been told to sit straighter, move less, or fear certain exercises, this episode might change the way you think about your body and your recovery. Adam, thank you so much for accepting my invitation to the show. I am incredibly excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you very much for the invite, Bernadette. I'm looking forward to this topic. It is quite an interesting and controversial topic. So I think we're going to have an interesting discussion, that's for sure.
Now, Adam, I remember when I was studying posture, we were using the Kendall book. Do you know the Kendall book?
No.
No, you don't. Testing and function with posture and pain.
Okay, not one I've come across.
So anyway, the one that showed all the diagrams of ideal posture and faulty posture. So is there really such a thing as good or bad posture? Or has our understanding of that changed?
Yes, I think our understanding is slow. Well, some people's understanding around posture is slowly changing, that's for sure. But to answer that question, no, there is no such thing as good or bad posture. Posture is remarkably variable and individual from person to person. And it can be variable in the same person within hour to hour and sometimes minute to minute. So our posture is variable, it's dynamic, and there has been quite a lot of research looking into the risks of certain different types of postures, looking to see whether there is any evidence of causation of one type of posture having greater risks of certain types of musculoskeletal problems or pathologies. And there is no strong evidence of any causation in any type of posture. So we don't see kyphotic postures or more upright postures or sway back postures or those with posterior pelvic tilt, anterior pelvic tilt, having either less or more back pain than those that have different types of postures. And this common belief about how neutral and perfect alignment is somehow the safer position and it is the better position and posture to be in hasn't held up very well at all. So, you know, people think and assume having a neutral pelvis and a perfectly aligned spine is some magical, mystical place where pain never occurs. And it's just not that simple. I often use an analogy here. And I use it based on my past experience when I served in the military. We were taught in the military to have a very upright posture when we're doing our ceremonial duties. And I can assure you that having to maintain a perfectly straight upright posture, standing on ceremony, was probably some of the most uncomfortable, unpleasant experiences I've ever had. And that's a perfect example of how, you know, posture that looks lovely, you know, visually and technically is perfect, can be very uncomfortable and painful for people. And I think that's what's happened a lot in the therapy world. A lot of therapists are telling people to go and sit in these postures and these positions. And it actually, I think, for a lot of people, makes them feel worse and more uncomfortable. And so giving people the opportunity and the freedom to explore variations in postures and positions, I think, is now a better position where a lot of therapists are slowly moving into. And they find a lot of variation, like I said, because some people do find that slouching is really, really comfortable for them. They like to have this kyphotic upper back and this posteriorly tilted pelvis. But other people, that can really be aggravational for their symptoms, mm-hmm. and they might prefer to be sitting with a bit more anterior tilt and a little bit less kyphosis to reduce their pain. So again, we just need to be looking at things as a more of individual one-on-one basis when it mm-hmm. comes to position and posture, rather than just globally painting everybody saying they have to have the same posture.
I remember when I was dealing with my back pain, that was over 10 years ago, they told me my back pain is because I have an anterior pelvic tilt.
And yeah, that's a common assumption. A lot of the time that is often blamed, anterior pelvic tilt, yeah.
And also my pelvis is out and I was scared and I was running to the chiropractor to have an adjustment. But, oh my God, my pelvis is out and I have a lordosis. Oh my goodness. And my posture is the same, but I don't have back pain.
Yeah. That's the other thing, you know, to consider is that, you know, you don't need to change posture to have less pain. You know, sometimes it does. Sometimes changing and modifying positions mm-hmm. and postures temporarily helps alleviate symptoms, but not all the time. And so, you know, we don't have to always think about making posture better or different to help people with their symptoms, because it's just not that simple.
Is it more like having this pressure from society that you have to look a certain way, you have to sit a certain way, you have to have your posture a certain way?
Yeah, I think historically and culturally, when you look back, where do these posture myths come from? I think originally people that were hunched over, bent over, twisted were often considered or seen to be evil or mischievous or have some other moral issue. I mean, you only have to look at Snow White and Disney in the cartoon. And the Wicked Witch, she was all bent over and curled and kyphotic, and she was evil and mischievous. And, you know, going back to things like World War II, Jewish propaganda as well, you know, they always see that the Jews, again, were hunched over, they were mischievous and evil. And I think historically, we've just, as a culture, has just assumed that being more upright and being more straight means that we're more honest and good and trustworthy. And so I think a lot of posture myths come from us wanting to appear to be honest and trustworthy and therefore not being bent over and hunched.
Do you think that also how we feel affects our posture?
Absolutely. You know, psychologically, you know, we can absolutely display that visually in our postures. So when people are feeling confident and happy, they are often, you know, upright and standing tall and proud.
Chest expanded,
shoulders are pulled back. You know, they're strutting around like a rooster on heat. But, you know, when people are feeling sad and depressed or low mood, then they tend to go in the opposite direction. They tend to curl in. We go into that natural fetal position, which is comforting for us, you know, because it makes us feel a bit safer and secure in this big, wide, bad world when we're not feeling on top of the world. So we like to go into ourselves. So absolutely, yeah, posture can be reflected of moods rather than anything else.
When I was dealing with back pain, I definitely didn't have an upright posture. It was more like I was kind of like curling up felt better, you know, kind of like slouching, and you know, that position felt definitely better. But Adam, if posture isn't the problem or the actual problem, then why does sitting for or standing for too long or slouching on the couch make so many of us feel sore or in pain?
Yeah, it's simply because of the time that we're in the posture, not the posture itself. So, you know, there is this common saying that a lot of more modern-based healthcare professionals are saying, you know, your best posture is your next posture. It's about having this ability to be able to change position and posture on a regular basis that seems to be something that helps us avoid getting pains and discomfort. It's when we have to maintain a position. And again, I go back to my analogy of being in the military, about having to stand on ceremonial duties for 2 or 3 hours static in one upright posture. That's going to cause pain and discomfort. If you had the ability to be able to change and move around, then you're less likely to have the pain and discomfort. So I think it's the time in the position rather than the position itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if I think about long haul flights, sitting for, like, we went to Australia last year and the flight was way too long, and sitting for too long, or even, you know, sleeping or not moving makes you sore.
It does. And I think there's probably an ischemic response in our tissues for that, I think, because when we are not moving, we are not circulating the fluids and the juices and the blood flow around as much as we should do. And I think that creates, you know, probably some physiological, chemical sort of changes. We're probably getting a little bit of increased acidosis in a few tissues, which then starts to sensitize our nerve endings. And that's when we start to feel that soreness. So there is biological and physiological explanations for this, which is why movement is essential for, you know, us as human beings to keep healthy and avoid these things. It's about having regular, often chances to change position, to move, to get these juices flowing, which is so important.
Especially our discs are less vascularized. They are not like the knees, or, you know, not like bones. And this is why probably it's really important to move our spine to get nourishment. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct. So, you know, when you've got a structure that is avascular, it's going to have to find another route to try and maintain its healthiness. It's going to have to find ways of getting nutrients in and removing waste products out. And the way that our discs and other structures, such as our hyaline cartilage, which is also avascular, doesn't have a blood supply, it's the movement of other fluid, water molecules, that allows things like nutrients to be transported into cells and waste products removed from cells. So it's this transfer of movement of fluid and water in and out of discs, tissues, annulus, fibrosis, hyaline cartilage, that helps maintain things better. So, you know, if we use arthritis as a classic example here, people often think arthritis is due to wear and tear, wearing out the cartilage. But a lot of arthritis is actually due to underloading. We're not actually loading the cartilage enough. And what that's probably doing is building up waste products from these cellular mechanisms that are not being able to be flushed out of the hyaline cartilage as quickly as they should do, which creates this toxic environment that starts this degenerative cascade within cartilage. So a lot of, say, cartilage samples from arthritic knee joints, hip joints, often have higher water content in them than healthy cartilage. Telling us this person is not moving enough and they're not squeezing out these waste products to load the cartilage, to keep it nourished, to keep it healthy. And I think it's exactly the same in the discs as well.
So not moving enough. Well, so the World Health Organization recommends 2 to 3 strength training sessions per week and 150 to 300 minutes of moderate cardio exercise like walking. So do you think that if a regular person follows the physical activity guidelines, that's actually a good base? Or
personally, I actually think you don't need to achieve that much. I actually think the World Health Organization have used that as an average. But I think you can still get great health benefits from sort of lower amounts. You know, if you can achieve those things, great, absolutely, go for it. But I think, you know, in this day and age, modern lifestyles, there are a lot of barriers to people engaging in cardiovascular exercise and strength exercise. And so I actually think, you know, a good starting place is 1 session a week for strength training. and probably, you know, just sometimes half an hour, three times a week, maybe even less than that, of moderate cardiovascular exercise would be a good starting place for most people. And I think, you know, they'll start to notice some benefits there, you know, and we see this as well in the walking literature as well. Often this 10,000 steps a day is recommended, but actually it doesn't need to be that high either. You know, you start to see significant health benefits in certain populations from as little as 6,000 to 7,000 steps a day. So again, one of the biggest barriers that puts people off from engaging in exercise is having these targets that just seem unachievable or a little bit too far out of reach. And I think those health organization guidelines for a lot of the population are just that little bit too much, a bit too intimidating. And I actually think it does the opposite, puts people off from starting. So I often say to people, have one session a week. That's all it needs to be. And start from there.
I believe any movement is better than no movement.
Oh, absolutely.
If you can even just move your spine 5 to 10 minutes a day, do a little bit of walking, I think that's better than sitting on the couch and doing nothing.
Some is better than none. Absolutely, Bernadette.
Exactly. So is there even such a thing as, well, we already discussed, there is no perfect posture. So what about the gym? When we go to the gym and we do squats, you know, like people are squatting or deadlifting, does posture or perfect form actually matter when we do those exercises?
Yes, again, this is quite a controversial area. And I think the safe place that I often answer this question to start off with is it depends. You know, that it depends on whether an exercise technique or position or posture matters, I think, in terms of two things. The first is, you know, does it matter in terms of it doing any harm or damage? Then I'm quite confident a lot of the time the answer is going to be no. So there is no strong evidence that the way that you perform an exercise, the technique you use, is going to have a significant risk on harm or damage to your body. I think what is more important to pay attention to is the dosing of the exercise. It's the load, it's the frequency, it's the intensity. Those variables are probably much more important to be paying attention to in terms of risk and injury than actually how you do the exercise. But, you know, if we're talking about things like when people have pain and they're doing an exercise, then I think there is a role here for saying, okay, perhaps how you're doing the exercise could be contributing to your symptoms. So, you know, I see some people who squat and it hurts in their back as they're squatting down, and a simple technique change in how they squat can make that squat feel completely different. Now, that obviously means that the technique is contributing to the symptoms, but the question we have is it causing their symptoms? Mm-hmm. That is the $64 million question that I don't think anybody with any confidence can answer. For me, because there is a lot of uncertainty around this, I will sit on the fence and say at the moment, we don't know. I am unlikely to think that, you know, these techniques that you're doing are the cause of your pain. They're obviously contributing to it now. So I think temporarily modifying how you do something is a good idea, but that doesn't mean it has to be a permanent change, and it doesn't mean you have to exercise this way forever once your pain has settled down.
I was experimenting. I like to actually lift heavy, and I was doing squats the other day, and I was going up with the weights this time, and my form definitely changed when I had more load.
Absolutely. I defy anybody to make a high intensity exercise look like a low intensity exercise, which a lot of trainers will say needs to be done. I'm not going to name any names, but a very influential Instagram person who has a university named after a type of exercise. will often say that every rep has to look the same regardless of the intensity. And I just think that's ignorant and arrogant and not correct at all. And I don't think it's a good position to be in, because as I say, you are probably purposely holding people back from pushing their intensity up a bit because of the technique doesn't look the same. But, you know, whenever you start to increase intensity, you're going to change the movement strategy of how you perform that task or exercise, because it's just not the same. So a body weight squat is going to feel and use a different strategy compared to a 2x body weight squat. You know, it's going to require, you know, a lot more effort from other body parts. You're going to find you're going to compensate in other areas to try and achieve the task and complete the squat. And that means that, say, the technique is going to look different. Is it risky? Is it dangerous because it is looking different? And again, I'd say no, I don't think it is. It just, there is no strong evidence at the moment that says how the exercise is done is the significant risk factor. It's more likely the lack of preparation that the person has had to the intensity of the exercise that's more likely to be the risk factor.
And also, if we are training people for strength, strength means, you know, that the last one or two reps, they are kind of like hard, right? I mean, it has to be hard. Otherwise, you're not pushing your body to its limits per se. But hopefully not the first or the second rep, but more like the 8th or the 10th rep. And that's probably the safe spot, right? If you are training for strength.
Again, it depends. I think it depends on the person's experience and exposure to how they've been doing strength training. So for somebody that's inexperienced, then yes, I think asking them to do heavy lifts where they're fatiguing probably under 4 or 3 repetitions is going to be a risky thing for them to do. But somebody who is an experienced power lifter, who has had 20 years of exposure of doing 1 rep maxes and doing 2 to 3 reps at very high intensities before they fatigue, for that individual, because they've had that exposure, I think their risk goes down significantly. And, you know, that's the same with endurance sports as well. So when people are training for marathons, you know, you tend to find those that have had experiences of running marathons for 10 years often can cope with the higher dosages and the higher intensities a lot better than a novice who's running their first marathon. So I think, again, it's the same in strength training with higher resistances.
What do you think about those posture tools? I was actually scrolling this morning through Instagram, and there is this posture device. You know, I don't know the name, but anyway. So braces and also standing desks, are they actually doing anything or just giving a false sense of control?
Well, again, I think what they're probably doing is they are temporarily changing people's behavior. So they are probably modifying how things feel. But are they needed or necessary to help people with pain? No. Are they oversold and overpromoted and overcomplicated? Absolutely, yes. You know, and they're overpriced a lot of the time as well, you know, for something that's just normally a piece of neoprene and some Velcro, and they're charging you hundreds, if not more, dollars for it. But, you know, these things are just aids to assist something while something's not feeling at its best. It's no different than using like a hot pack or a paracetamol or a Band-Aid. You know, you're just using an implement to temporarily modify or change something. But as I said, I don't think they're necessary or needed a lot of the time for most people.
I see a couple of people walking around in the grocery store with back braces to protect their spine. What do you think about those?
I think when people become dependent on them, that's when they start becoming a problem. And that's where I think sometimes that's where the downside of these devices is people are told, you know, they've got to use them all the time. And then they start to encroach on normal activities like going grocery shopping or going to drive the car. You know, if I haven't got my lumbar support in my car, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to drive the car. And I think that's a pretty shitty way to go through life, where you feel like you have to depend on a piece of foam or a neoprene brace. You know, that's not what we should be doing with people and their bodies. We should be making people feel robust and resilient with their bodies and not dependent on these crutches and these aids. Temporarily, whilst you're not feeling good at, you know, a specific time, no problem with it at all. But you don't want to be using it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of your life. No way.
It takes away your confidence in your own body, right? You'll be scared to move.
Yeah, it adds, you know, that sort of fear. Oh my God, I'm easily damaged. I'm easily broken. If I don't have this, I can't do that. And I just think that's not a good way to go through life. It restricts your life. And say, when people's life gets restricted, then their symptoms often feel a lot worse, you know, because we haven't got as much life to live and our symptoms are taking up more room. You know, if our lives are bigger and our symptoms are the same, then we don't tend to notice them as much.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people are afraid to slouch or sit cross-legged or bend their back, especially if they had, you know, back pain forever or before. Is that fear, you know, justified, or are we being overly just cautious?
So again, I think it depends on how long these things have been going on for. So, you know, if somebody has hurt their back 2 weeks ago and they're bending over, and every time they're bending over, they're getting this real sharp pain in their lower back. And, you know, it really puts them off from bending over, and they say, you know what, you know, I'm going to bend with my knees a bit more. I'm going to keep my back straight. I'm not going to bend it. I think that's perfectly okay. I think that's a normal, natural thing for human beings to do when they're in pain. I go back to when I had my back issue. Everybody was telling me, you know, I've got to do the certain techniques. I've got to go into extensions to reduce my disc herniation. Moving into extension was the most uncomfortable thing I could possibly do. So I tried it, didn't like it. And I said, you know what? I'm going to avoid it. I'm not going to do that. And so I think that's a sensible approach to take, because it just aggravates symptoms. But if I was still not going into extension 6 months, a year, 2 years down the line, then no, I don't think that's helpful at all. And that's where I see a lot of people coming into my clinics, you know, with that sort of time frame of they've had this issue originally a year ago. It's still there. They've still got these fears. They still don't want to do these things because they believe it's dangerous or harmful for them. That's not a healthy position to be in again. And so, again, that's where we have to try, I think, to convince people that, you know, the movements themselves are not the reason why they've got pain. It's normally the fear and the anxiety about the movement that is contributing to it more. But sometimes the only way around to prove to them is to get them to do the thing they don't want to do. We're using this sort of graded exposure approach. Normally, as I say, that can be quite difficult and challenging to do, to convince somebody to do something they don't really want to do. To prove to them that it's okay and it's safe and it isn't going to be dangerous or harmful for them. It can be really challenging.
Yes. I had a client recently who hurt her back by bending over to get something out of the freezer. And then, you know, she was in pain. And then I told her, we slowly have to expose you to that movement, right? Gradually. And then she's like, no, I don't want to do that movement. I'm going to hurt my back again. So it's not, we know it is simple, but for them, it can be really, really scary because they just want to avoid the movement. They already have bad experience and they become fearful.
Yeah. And they've been told by multiple people before you, they've seen you, that it is dangerous and harmful, you know, and then we come along and say, no, it isn't, you know, and that causes them a lot of confusion, and they're like, well, who do I believe? Who do I trust? And so it can take a lot of trust building in somebody like that for them to start to realize that perhaps you are the more trustworthy person. And these other people have sometimes perhaps unintentionally or intentionally misinformed them about these things. Mm-hmm. But that takes time to do. And unfortunately, I think in a lot of healthcare settings, a lot of us don't have the luxury of that time, you know, because of lack of resources, lack of insurance cover. Mm-hmm. You know, lack of financial money from the people to come and see us on regular appointments over a few months, it can make it really challenging to work with these people because we're just lacking that time to build that trust and relationship with them, to convince them it's okay, it's safe to do. But if we can, it's one of the best feelings in the world to convince her. I had a lady who hadn't bent over for nearly 30 years. She had never picked up her grandchildren. Mm-hmm. They'd gone through 30 years of fearing bending over. She'd had two fusions of her spine. She'd been told, her back was made of Swiss cheese and it will explode and crumble. And I worked with her weekly for probably 6 months, building her trust and earning her rapport. And gradually, slowly, steadily, step by step, we convinced her to bend over her and expose her. And she started to realize it wasn't as bad as everyone was making out until she eventually was bending over, picking up 20 kilogram kettlebells off the floor. And at the end, she was really pleasantly surprised, but also quite frustrated and angry at the world because she'd had 30 years of her life really badly affected when it probably didn't need to be.
Yep. I had also a client who started with me in January, and she had a lumbar fusion. And after the lumbar fusion, the doctor recommended Pilates, clinical Pilates for her after the lumbar fusion. And she started in January, and she was on opioids. And I had one of the pain management doctors working with me here, had to work with her, So anyway, and now she's off the opioids since mid-March. And she also has three grandchildren, and she went dancing, and she feels good, and she doesn't see me as much anymore.
Beautiful. That is one of the best feelings in the world, working in this job. I just wish they happened more often.
Absolutely. And I'm so grateful for the pain management doctor as well, because I didn't know how to navigate in the beginning.
Right.
Because if you're on heavy opioids, she wasn't even driving because she was taking medication, and she wouldn't know where is her pain tolerance. So that was great. But also I wanted to go back and touch base on, for example, if someone is hurting her back picking up a toy, then we also have to ask the question, how many times do you do that in real life, right? So that's why graded exposure comes here, and it's really important to expose you to that movement so your body is strong enough to do that, right?
Yeah, I don't know if it's just about strength. I think it's more about, that sort of fear side of it, the mental strength, perhaps, rather than the physical strength.
Exactly.
Of being able to build that trust back in your body, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely, definitely. So why do you think so many physios and trainers and even doctors still focus on fixing posture when someone has back pain?
Oh, that's easy to answer, because it is easy and simple to do. Mm-hmm. It's the simplest and easiest thing to blame. It's plausible to a lot of people that we see. It just has a lot of face validity, just makes sense. Oh, yeah, it must be my posture. Culturally, like we've talked about, a lot of people are brought up with it being a causative factor. So it's just easy to tell somebody that your pain is due to your poor posture and your position. It's a lot harder to tell somebody that their pain in their back is due to perhaps their lifestyle or lack of sleep or high stress levels, or that it's just due to uncertain or unknown factors. That's incredibly difficult to do, and that requires a lot of confidence and, again, time for a physio or a trainer or a doctor to be able to go through and explain that carefully, compassionately, without invalidating, without confusing the person. And it's incredibly challenging and difficult to explain it and do it well to patients. So a lot of the time it's like, it's your posture. That's why you got back pain. It takes 3 seconds to do, minimal cognitive effort, job done.
I used to say that when people were joining my back to movement program, that you'll feel the difference between 2 to 4 months. And as I'm working with more and more clients, I realize I stopped saying that, because I cannot say that anymore, because for some people it takes 9 months, 12 months. And then from the back, it goes to the shoulder. And then, because pain sensitization, pain moves, especially if you had chronic back pain for 10, 15 years, I cannot fix the problem. I would love to, I cannot fix the problem in 2 to 4 months. You feel probably better, And we don't know, you might still be in pain, but your life will be better. You'll be able to move better. You know, you'll be more confident, but there is going to be some level of pain.
Yeah, my advice when I go around teaching physios, trainers and coaches is, you know, somebody says, how long is it going to take before it feels better? Is never, ever, ever give them a time frame. Instead, talk about the high variability and the individual differences in how long things can take from person to person. I always say two people with exactly the same problems, exactly the same pathologies, can have two extremely different outcomes and the time it takes to get those outcomes as well. You know, we might have one person with this problem, 3 weeks, it feels significantly better. The other person, it could be 6 months, 9 months before it starts to feel significantly better. It's the same problem. It's the same pathology. It's the same level, but they've got two different variable outcomes. And so I think it's these discussions that are much more useful for patients and explaining them that how that, you know, it's very hard for us to know exactly how long it's going to take for you because we have this wide variation in timeframes. You know, the research does help us. You know, when you look into clinical research trials that use various different treatments for things like back pain, shoulder pain, and they look at their outcome measures, we do see, you know, time factors that, you know, a vast majority of people go through. So we can get some average time frames, but there's a lot of individual variation in that. So I teach a lot around shoulder pain. So normally that's subacromial shoulder pain. You know, a lot of people think the average time frame is 3 months. It's not. It's double that. It's closer to 6 to 9 months is the average. Mm-hmm. But best case scenario could be as quick as 3 months. So it can get better in 3 months, but not many do. Average is 6 to 9 months. But we also see other people on the other side that can take 12 to 18 months before it starts to feel better. So these are the conversations when people ask, how long is it going to take, that we should be having, rather than just saying 2 to 4 months or 3 to 6 weeks. Yeah.
Exactly. And do you think it's because, I mean, we all have different pain level. We have different lives. We have different traumas. We have different, you know, we are all unique and different. So there is no one size fits all solution.
Yeah, I think the reasons why, you know, it takes longer in some people versus others, again, is due to their past exposures, past experiences, beliefs, lifestyle, age,
other medical conditions.
Yeah, all these other factors, you know, all these things will influence the rate and the speed of how things go over time. Yeah.
And we already touched base on this one. How much of a role do stress, fear or mood actually play in back pain recovery compared to things like posture or what shows up on a scan?
Again, I think it is hard to say from person to person. I think, you know, it depends on the person and the populations perhaps you're seeing, you know, but I would say, you know, for example, occupational back pain. So people, you know, work in jobs that involve bending and lifting and twisting or standing for long periods of time. I think the more important factor that we see in the research that tells us why so many people get back pain in these jobs is because of their job satisfaction rather than their postures and positions that they're using. So we often find that employees who enjoy their job more have less back pain than those who don't enjoy their job. So regardless of the positions and postures they're in. So if you've got somebody, you know, is working in an Amazon warehouse, but they actually enjoy working for Amazon, they find them a good company to work for, they're quite happy with their terms and conditions and their reimbursements and their financial rates, you know, they often, you know, don't get back problems, even though they are bending and twisting and turning and lifting and doing all these things on a regular basis. But somebody else who works for the same company who really doesn't enjoy working for the company and finds it not really a satisfying job and they don't feel like they've got good value for money, then they are probably going to suffer with more back pain at the end of the day. So I think, yeah, for a lot of people, it's about job satisfaction and these other factors other than, you know, postural position.
It's really interesting what you said, because my back pain started when I worked in a private clinic back in Australia. And I was just, I liked my work, but I didn't like sitting all day for 8 to 10 hours. And my back was killing me.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, it's not the actual position, it's the job that you're probably doing and whether you're enjoying it or not. So, you know, there are some office workers who absolutely love their job. Look at gamers, you know, these people that are on video games, professional video, they sit in the most awkward positions and postures you could possibly imagine, and they do it for hours and hours and hours, but they're so hyper-focused and enjoying what they're doing, playing their video games, that they don't get any symptoms at all. Yet you get somebody working for an accountancy firm, you know, going through the files, who finds it really boring. They are sitting in an ergonomically designed chair with all the things and the gadgets around them, and their back's still killing them, even though they're sitting in so-called a better posture. It's because of the environment and the context of what they're doing, probably dictating how they're feeling, not their posture.
Yeah, very fascinating, actually. Do you play video games, Adam?
I don't. I used to, but I've got a bit of an addictive personality. So I found myself getting very, very, I found myself one day, I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd looked up and I was like, oh my God, I should have gone to bed like 4 or 5 hours ago. So now I knocked that on the head and decided to put my addictive personality into other things that I thought were slightly a bit more healthy and better for me.
That's my 9-year-old son. Yeah. He just loves it. And most awkward positions never has back pain.
Exactly. It's, again, it's the enjoyment and the engagement that they get in that completely makes that posture and position feel completely different. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's the, well, per se risk if someone focuses only on posture or their physical body and completely ignores the emotional and psychological side of pain?
Well, I think the biggest risk is that they're probably not going to get much improvement because they're focusing on the wrong things. You know, it's a bit like...
like weak glutes, weak core, bad posture.
If you're focusing on something that's not really a contributing factor and you're not addressing a contributing factor, then you're probably going to still have the same problem 3 months down the line, maybe even longer. So I think that's the biggest risk.
Now, tell us the contributing factors, since you said contributing factors, Adam.
Well, that's the thing. It's trying to work out what they are. And
Tell me some.
Yeah, well, I can't, because there are a list as long as your arm. There are many, many different potential contributing factors. And that's where we need this personalized approach, this individualized one-to-one approach, because there's no such thing as standard back pain. Everybody's back pain is their back pain. It's a different type of back pain with different contributing factors. For so one person, the contributing factor may be the chair that they're sitting in. For somebody else's, it may be they're only getting 4 hours of sleep. Somebody else's, it might be they're drinking 6 cans of high strength lager every night. They've got an amount of stress going on. So, you know, it's about finding out what the person's background is, what their life is, what their aggravating factors are, what their past medical history is, what their current medical history is. All of these things should come into our assessment processes for us to try and have some guesses. And I am going to say it's a guess about what might be the contributing factors, picking a few of these things, changing them, seeing what responses do or don't happen, and then taking it from there.
Like lack of sleep?
I think lack of sleep is, for some people, a contributing factor. Yeah, absolutely. But I find a lot of fear and nocebo around sleep now. It's almost gone the other way, you know, thanks to people like, what's his name, Huberman, and, you know, that Andrew Walker with his book that he brought out that was, you know, a New York Times bestseller. There's just this fear about, oh my God, if you don't get your 8.5 hours sleep, you're going to be fucked for the rest of your life. And I'm like, no, it's not that simple. There are many, many people who are sleep deprived, functioning very well at high levels, and they can do it sometimes for long periods of time. Ask any parent, you know, are you getting your regular
sleep?
Tell
me about it.
Yeah.
I have many moms sleep deprived having back pain, and we all know why.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there are people out there that are sleep deprived and don't get back pain as well.
Yeah,
so
true.
I think it's a case of it is potentially a contributing factor for some, but I just think we've got to relax about blaming it.
It's not just that. It can be a contributing factor, but it's not just the sleep. It's the stress. It is lack of physical activity. Like, we don't know. It's a combination of things, like a cocktail, right?
That's a nice analogy. Absolutely. A cocktail of contributing factors. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And everyone's cocktail is different. We like different cocktails, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Anything.
Do you like any cocktail, Adam? What's your favorite?
Well, I'm quite a simple one. So I normally go for either a, I've forgotten. What's the one with vodka and ginger ale? A Moscow Mule.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Moscow Mule is one of my favorites. Or a simple gin and tonic as well, because I'm English.
I like Negronis.
They're a little bit strong for me. I've tried a few of those, but they are...
I love bitter.
They pack a punch, they do. I don't mind the taste, but I think, you know, one is probably enough. Any more than that, you're on the floor.
Yeah, that's it. Or even half. Talking from experience, no?
Yeah.
Okay. So if posture and structure aren't the big keys, what is worth focusing on for someone who wants to recover and feel better?
Well, again, you know, I'm going to go back to the it all depends on the person in front of us with the back pain. There isn't just this generic things that people can do. You know, there are some big rocks. You know, living a healthy lifestyle, trying to be as happy as you possibly can, go a long, long way to help improve a lot of symptoms. So I often say to people, because I get these questions like, can I carry on doing this? And I say, does it make you feel happy and healthy? And if they say yes, I'm like, carry on doing it. If it doesn't make you feel happy and healthy and it's doing the opposite, then it's probably something you might want to stop doing. So, you know, I think, you know, it's these things in our life that are perhaps causing our symptoms rather than these things like weak glutes or weak cores or bad posture. It's the things that make us feel unhappy or unhealthy. They're the things to perhaps try to focus on more.
What do you suggest or what's your advice to someone who comes and see you with back pain? Usually, what do you tell them?
Who comes to see me with back pain? What's
with chronic back pain? I had back pain for 5 years, Adam. You know, I'm sleeping 7 to 9 hours, though. I enjoy my life. Yeah. Tell me, what should I do?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing I try to tell the people is if you've had pain for a long period of time, doesn't mean you're broken. Doesn't mean that something needs fixing. And it doesn't mean that you're fragile. You know, back pain, very common, can be seriously painful, but very rarely serious. And even when it hurts like hell, most of the time it will settle. And the best thing you can keep doing is keep moving, stay active, stop chasing the quick fixes and the miracle cures and the bullshit scans, because they're only going to tell you, you know, you're damaged or you're broken or you've got something that needs fixing. And you say you just don't need to have perfect posture. You don't need to have a strong core. You don't need to have an ergonomically designed chair or a posturepedic mattress to feel confident and safe in your body. And it's about being strong in your body, in your mind, as well as being adaptable in your body and your mind as well. And as I say, it doesn't mean that just because you've had pain for a long time, it's going to be there forever. Doesn't mean you're stuck. You just need to say probably to focus on other things going on in your life, like I said, that probably are making you feel unhappy and unhealthy. Try to work out what those are. Try to think about how you can think about changing those to make you feel a little bit happier and a little bit healthier. And I normally say small things can make a big difference. So it doesn't need to be a massive change. You know, you don't need to suddenly upheave your life. You don't need to start going to the gym every day. You don't need to start running marathons. You don't need to start changing your diet massively. It's sometimes a little slight change that just makes things feel that little bit different that has a big impact on your symptoms. So that's the normal sort of conversations I'm having with people with chronic pain.
I know exercise is the best thing we can do for back pain. However, when you are in pain, that's the last thing you want to do. Like you say, oh, squats are great. Even deadlifts are great with back pain. And I do know that. I follow you. And I agree with that. But if I would tell this to my client who had lumbar fusion, she would literally, you know, walk away and say goodbye, you know.
Yep.
And we know there is no best exercise. There is no such thing. We are all unique and different, right? However, if I would tell this to my client, oh, deadlifts are great, she would run away.
Yeah, no, and I totally agree, and I totally get that as well. You know, I have a lot of patients who the first thing they say, sometimes they just look at me and they go, oh, this guy works out. I don't want to do any exercise. They'll say that. You know, the first thing is like, don't think I'm going to be lifting any weights. I'm not going to turn in and start looking like you. And I'm like, no, it's fine. I'm not going to influence my beliefs and my ideas of what I do for my own training onto you. You know, so I think a lot of people think that physio exercises have to be resistance-based exercises, they have to be high-intensity exercises, and they don't. A lot of our rehab exercises can be very low-intensity and sometimes non-resistance-based. You know, I think walking is probably one of the best things people can do for back pain, really is. I sometimes say to people it's a bit like a balm for backs. Walking, you know, instead of getting your tiger balm out and rubbing it onto your back, go for a little walk down the street, get out into the open fresh air a little bit, which can be more challenging for some people than others depending on where they're living, you know, but you know, a little bit of extra steps goes wonderfully far for people with back pain. So yeah, it doesn't always have to be deadlifts, bird dogs, planks. Absolutely not.
It depends what do you want to do, what's your goal. If your goal is to do deadlifting, then we have to do the deadlifts. If you want to be able to, you know, pick up heavy boxes, heavy deliveries, because you order things from Amazon, then we have to practice that. We have to do the things in order to get better at them.
The specific adaptation to imposed demand, the said principle, is key in a lot of what we do, you know, not just in training, but in life. You know, you get better at the things by doing the things that you want to get better at. Yeah.
I mean, I was Pilates instructor before I had my son, and I had him. And what do you do when you're a, you know, young mom? You bend over, you're flexing your spine, and that baby grows fast. And I was like, oh, my back is killing me. And I was a Pilates instructor for years dealing with people with back pain, but I wasn't prepared to do that movement, because in Pilates we didn't do those movements, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, oh my God.
Well, some Pilates do. I see Pilates. Two schools of Pilates. I see those that are very much focused on variability and allowing people.
What I was doing before was different.
Yeah.
And I've got retrained with Bridge Education, with Raf, and things changed.
Yeah,
for
Raph,
the better.
Raph and Chloe over in Australia. They're great. They're Pilates elephants guys. They're great. Yeah.
Exactly. So I've got my diploma, and my, you know, the way I train people is changed. More like functional training. What do you gonna, you know, what do you wanna be good at? Low specificity, doing the things you wanna be able to do in real life.
Absolutely.
So anyway, that was really interesting. So when should someone be concerned about their back pain? Because we know the red flags, right? So,
well, some know the red flags. Not everybody knows the red flags, unfortunately. I've had a few that have been missed, unfortunately, by other therapists with patients that come to see me. But, you know, the first thing is that, you know, back pain is very, very common. But serious problems with back pain are very, very uncommon. So that's the first thing I want to say. So these things very, very rarely are serious or sinister a lot of the time. So we're probably talking less than a 1% chance that these things are going to occur. But anybody that's got, you know, very severe and progressively worsening pain, especially if they've had a fall or a trip, and especially if they're the older population, you know, one of the more common uncommon things is spinal fractures in the more older osteoporotic population. So that is a red flag. So severe progressively worsening pain after a trip or a fall, especially if there is, you know, a bony deformity, which you very rarely see in the lumbar or thoracic spine, or very point tenderness to touch onto a bony prominence. Those are the individuals that normally need some further imaging just to make sure there isn't a spinal fracture. The other one, again, is severe neurological symptoms in the lower limbs. So like complete weakness, foot drop of the foot dorsiflexors, complete loss of numbness, again, in certain areas, particularly around the saddle area. So this area around the genitals, or the area that you'd sit on a bike. that again probably needs urgent referrals and further investigations. And also if there are bladder and bowel control issues around that as well. The other one with neurological symptoms is bilateral neurological symptoms. So if somebody has bilateral numbness in the feet or the legs or bilateral neurological mm-hmm. symptoms as well, that probably also needs, again, some further tests and investigations. And then the last one that is very, very uncommon is it could be, you know, something like a metastases or a tumor, mm-hmm. you know, so mm-hmm. people sometimes can have these things masquerading as musculoskeletal pain, but they're very hard to spot in the early stages. But if somebody has already had a previous history of cancer, if they've got things like losing weight without actually trying to lose weight, they've got, you know, systemic reactions, they're feeling feverish, suffering with fatigue and malaise, that could be an indication, as I say, of something like a tumor mm-hmm. or possibly an infection in the spine that would need further tests and investigations. But again, I don't want people to worry because they are very uncommon. But mm-hmm. you know, these are the things to keep an eye out for.
I have a friend who lives in Sweden and he fell on ice and he had a spinal fracture and he walked into the hospital because he had no one around him.
Yeah, a lot of spinal fractures, you know, they are still able to move. They're not like a broken leg. So, you know, they're normally either a compression fracture, a wedge fracture of the vertebral body, or a spinous process or a pars articularis defect mm-hmm. as well. So they are still able to weight bear, but it is really uncomfortable for them. They have really severe pain and this point tenderness.
Yeah. He walked into the hospital and he told them, oh, I just, you know, fall. And they told him, oh, just sit in the, you know, in the waiting area. And then he got the MRI and they told him, don't move, stop moving, don't do anything. But then he was waiting in the waiting area walking before. They were not worried. He had a fracture.
Yeah, my wife fractured her pelvis and her L5 vertebrae from falling from a horse. Oh. And she walked back from the fall from the horse and we did the same thing. We took her into A&E because she was pain and weight bearing, point tenderness. Mm-hmm. And I said, let's take you to A&E. And she was like, no, it'll be okay. I've just bashed it. And I said, no, this. And they sent her for a CT scan, emergency CT scan. And yeah, found a fracture in her pelvis and L5 vertebrae. She couldn't believe it. She was like, well, how am I still able to move and walk around? I said, it's what spinal fractures do. But there you go. Yeah.
So how long it took for her to kind of like recover?
So she was struggling definitely for the first 6 to 8 weeks with her weight bearing and mobilization. It was a stable fracture, so they're quite happy for her to mobilize as pain mm-hmm. allowed. And it took her about 6 to 8 weeks to get through the worst of the pain and then probably another 3 months, 4 months to feel like mm-hmm. she was confident enough to get back on the horse again.
Mm-hmm. She went back on the horse. Oh, my goodness.
Oh yeah, horse people, you know, won't stop riding horses. So it's not the only thing she's broken. This is just the number 5 or 6 injuries she's had. So she did actually say when she was in the CT scan, or when they told her after the CT scan, she goes, "I am thinking perhaps this is the last one." And I was like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah," because I knew in a couple of months' time when she started feeling better, the next thing she wants to do is get back on the horse.
Yeah,
so, yeah, 6 months and she was back riding again.
Now, Adam, do you think the physio world is finally shifting or moving past the whole posture obsession, or are we still kind of stuck there?
There are some slow, slight changes I've seen in my time. You know, I've been doing this now for 25 years, nearly a quarter of a century, which is why I've got all the gray hair.
You don't look that old, Adam.
Oh, thank you very much. I feel it. I really do. But there is some slow changes I can see slowly. I'm seeing, you know, the power of social media for good and bad. You know, it does spread a lot of misinformation, but it also means that there's a lot of people out there challenging and critiquing the misinformation as well. So I am beginning to see things slowly change, but it isn't changing fast enough that I would like, and there is still a lot of nonsense and bullshit out there, yeah.
Have you ever had back pain? Oh, yeah, you mentioned you had back pain, right?
Multiple times, yeah. Something that I always tell, you know, therapists, never be ashamed about. There is this strange thing that physios feel like, oh, I must be a bad physio if I've had a back problem or a shoulder problem. I'm like, that's stupid. Doctors get ill. Does a doctor feel like they're bad if they get bloody an illness? Does a surgeon feel like they're a bad surgeon because they need to go and get surgery? No. Why would physios feel bad because they're injured themselves playing football or ruptured their ACL or hurt their back doing a deadlift like I did? You're not a bad physio or a trainer just because you have injuries. I actually think it makes you better.
Exactly, because you know how it feels. You can relate.
Absolutely. You get that one-to-one exposure and experience yourself. You actually put yourself in the patient's shoes. So I think more physios actually need to get more injuries to realize how difficult it is and how sometimes the things that they ask people to do and say perhaps aren't quite as good as they thought it was, because you can start to see it from the other side of the coin. And it also, I think, shows physios about how to treat people, because I treated my back problem exactly the way I treat a lot of other people's back problems, which is give it time, try not to panic, keep moving a little bit, do a little bit more each day if you can. If you have a bad day, back off a bit. Doesn't need anything fancy. Don't need to do bird dogs. Don't need a 1,000-pound electrotherapy machine. You just, you know, give it some time, be patient, more patient than you'd want to be. And try not to stress too much, but you are going to. You're going to have some bad days. You're going to think the worst. Work through it, and it'll be okay. So that was the message I was putting out there in my vlogs, and that's the way I treated myself. And, that's something else I think is a positive. If a physio gets injured and they treat it well themselves, then they can pass that on to their patients.
Absolutely. And I don't think back pain recovery is linear. I just had a client who... we've been doing really well for 2-3 months, and she had to lift her dog a couple of weeks ago because the dog got sick, and the dog is 80 pounds and she wasn't prepared to move the dog in the car, but she had to, and then terrible back pain. But luckily she didn't give up. We are still going, but it's tough. So these things happen. We just have to, you're going to have a flare up if you do something, because life happens, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Setbacks are normal. You know, I think it's more normal to have setbacks going through a recovery process than it is not to have setbacks. If somebody goes through it, as you say, on a linear process, that is probably a 1% occurrence. That very rarely happens. 99% of the time, there is going to be a week or a day or something that you do that just feels horrible, and you feel like you've gone back to square one again. Perfectly normal. Perfectly normal.
Now, Adam, can you tell the listeners when they are in good hands, if they are looking for a physical therapist? How do they know?
I think the signs of a good therapist is one that is open and honest with you and doesn't just tell you things that you want to hear and doesn't just do things that you want to have done, like the massage or the laser machine or the cupping or the scraping. But also, you know, is somebody that will listen to your problems and give you some, you know, sensible, rational advice about how to work around them or how to try to make them less of a problem. And somebody that is there to support and guide you rather than fixing you. Somebody that claims they can fix this and do this and heal this. They're the ones that are normally the shysters and the charlatans. But somebody that is saying, look, I'm here to help, support, guide, encourage, motivate you through this process, of which, you know, time is going to do a lot of the work here, but, you know, I'm going to help you with a few strategies, a few things to make it smoother journey. That's the sign of a good therapist.
So if someone is listening right now and feels totally hopeless about their back pain, what's one thing you want them to hear today?
Oh, I'm going to go back to that same thing again. You're not broken. You're not fragile. You're strong. You're robust. You're adaptable. It's a bad time at the moment, but it doesn't mean it's going to be a bad time forever.
Perfect. Thank you so much for the message, Adam. And thank you so much for accepting the invitation and taking time having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bernadette. Yeah, I've enjoyed it. It's been a nice conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for the listenings, for tuning into the Back to Movement podcast. This is all for this episode, folks, and we see you next time.